newcastlechurch.org. This is Christ the Center, Episode 23, The Federal Vision. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, a weekly conversation in Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and today I'm joined by both Jeff Waddington and Jim Cassidy, who are pastors at Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. Good evening, guys.
Good evening.
Hey, Camden.
We're also pleased to welcome back Nick Batzig, who is interim pastor at Christ the King PCA in Conshohocken, Pennsylvania. How are you doing, Nick?
Good. How are you, Camden?
Good. And also joining us today is the Reverend Lane Keister from Hall Christian Reformed Church and Hope Reformed Church. We're pleased to have you on, Lane.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
Yeah, thanks. Lane is somewhat known as an authority figure. At least he's well-versed in the federal vision, so we're really excited to have him on and to talk about that that very topic and how it relates to Reformed theology. But first, we, of course, want to announce any announcements, any new books, publications, any tips or tricks, anything that's worth mentioning to our listeners. Guys, is there anything out there?
No. Yes. I'm sorry.
Sleep at the wheel.
the new volume on, I don't have it in front of me, but the on Karl Barth and Reformed Theology, do you have that actual exact title, Camden?
No.
I think it's called Calvin, Barth, and Reformed Theology or something like that.
I believe that is exactly right. And I think it's a Paternoster title.
Yes.
One of those silver and purple.
Oh, I got cover. It. Okay.
That is now available, and that is co-edited by Carl Truman and Neil McDonald. So this
Calvin
is a...
Barth.
Yeah, this is a dialogue between conservative Bible believing Reformed and neo Orthodox theologians. So it's a really good tool for especially in our day and age. Any comments, Jimbo?
No, I was just going to add to that the annual Karl Barth conference at Princeton Seminary is on Monday. The topic is on Karl Barth and theological ethics. Promises to be a very interesting conference again this year, and they're going to be bringing in scholars from literally all over the world. So anybody who is interested in perhaps attending some of those sessions can look on the Princeton website. You can also buy or purchase the audio versions after the conference as well.
And I'll put that on the calendar, too, so that we can see that. If there's anyone in the Princeton area, that'll be
good. And if you're going, I'll be there, so let me know, and we can hook up for some lunch or something.
Cool.
Unless you're a Bardian, in which case I forget about it.
What will you meet up for if they're Bardian? Just kidding.
Well, you might get the dinner within the dinner that way, you know.
Oh my!
We have a couple other new books I'm looking at. There seems to be a new title by Robert Raymond. Has anyone seen that? Faith's Reasons for Believing.
Oh,
and he's not
okay.
Not coming from a Vantillian perspective.
No, he's a Clarkian, right, Lane?
Right. Oh yeah.
Okay.
So he's still
worth reading.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, he's now pastoring an OPC church down in Florida,
Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah, and he's being assisted by Cal Beisner.
That is correct.
So that's interesting. But anyway, so that's worth reading. Anything else there, Camden?
Yeah, Richard Baxter and Conversion by Timothy, looks like Bauer. I don't know how to pronounce that.
Oh, okay.
B-E-O-U-G-H-E-R. from Christian Focus. And there's a couple others. I'll just name here one more. 18 Words, The Most Important Words You Will Ever Know by Jim Packer. I don't know much about that one either. I said Christian Focus has just come out with a couple new titles. I don't know if these are exactly new or perhaps new to the Westminster Bookstore. That might
it
be
could
the case.
Be the Packer title. I'm not sure. It could be a reprint of a previously published volume.
Hmm.
A lot of his works are like that these days.
And then we do also have a book by Andreas Kustenberger and Scott Swain.
Yeah.
Father, Son, and Spirit, The Trinity and John's Gospel.
Yeah, that's part of the New Studies in Biblical Theology, right?
Yeah, it's in that set.
Edited by D.A. Carson.
Mm-hmm.
So any of those volumes are worth reading in that series.
Yeah, I have a number of them. I haven't read as many as I'd like to yet, but they're good to have.
It seems like there's about 20 in that series.
It's
now.
Big,
it's,
isn't
it's
it?
A large. It's a large series now, yeah. It got bounced around, you know, from publisher to publisher. It was it's now IVP, but at one time it was Erdman's, and then I think InterVarsity. Before InterVarsity there was someone else. So this is like the third publisher.
Oh, okay.
But it's stuck with IVP. IVP is the publisher that has the silver cover. So it seems to have struck a chord with the InterVarsity reading crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the series that has that excellent volume on the temple and the church's mission by mm-hmm. Greg Beale.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Wonderful volume.
Yeah, it is.
Well, do we have anything else to mention? Anything worthwhile that our listeners would like to hear, would like to know? I'm not coming up with anything off the top of my head.
I was trying to think. Again, we're in that slow season. I would guess we could plug the Gaffin Festschrift again.
We have done that enough. How many times do I have to add that to our bibliography? It's like I got a shortcut built into my keyboard now. It just plugs it into our show notes.
Automatic pilot, right? That's a good volume to plug again. You'll also see it on the website for the Westminster Seminary if you go there and you see the revolving items that appear on the homepage. It will show up. So that's a good volume.
Okay. Well, since we've about run out of things to talk about in terms of announcements, we might as well get on to our topic, which is why you're all listening anyway and why I'm here personally. The Federal Vision. What exactly is that? Lane, could you give us just maybe a brief overview? Because this is a really slippery topic, but it's a controversy that came up a few years ago, and it's really caused a lot of, well, at least blog ink to be spilled. So maybe if you give us just an overview of what the Federal Vision is, and we can go from there.
Sure. The Federal Vision is... usually described by its proponents as being something like a conversation about various loci in systematic theology. But it focuses really on a particular view of the covenant. That's hence the term federal in Federal Vision, and a way of looking at it, hence the word vision. So it's a way of looking at covenant. And their particular way of looking at covenant is as an objective view of the covenant. In other words, the covenant is something that you can fingerprint and identify because people are baptized into covenant, and all members of the church are in covenant with God, at least in some way. Of course, there are distinctions to be made even among Federal Vision advocates as to what exactly that means, whether... but usually, the Federal Vision authors will not say that just because you're in covenant, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to heaven. So they make a distinction between two different kinds of election. And this aspect of covenant and election really owes a lot, I think, to Norman Shepherd's book, The Call of Grace, which in many ways kind of precipitated all of the Auburn Avenue pastors' conferences that started in 01, which is right after Shepherd's book came out in 2000. But if you really want to see the origins of it, you have to really say that there are elements of Norman Shepherd, Jim Jordan's hermeneutics, and probably also some of the forms of Dutch Reformed a la Klaus Schilder involved also with what they want to say about the covenant is that what's true of one member of the covenant is really kind of true for everybody in the covenant.
Okay.
And Lane, so the, yeah.
Would you say that they make covenant equal with relationship with God?
Yes. Yeah, so the definition of covenant is not a contractual agreement in Federal Vision Theology, but it is defined as relationship. And there, of course, there is sort of underlying view of the Trinity as covenant, mm-hmm. which comes mm-hmm. from the books of Ralph Smith. So there you have, and actually Ralph Smith, I believe, also has antecedents in Jim Jordan's Through New Eyes. I think he advocates that view of the Trinity in that book as well. So the view of covenant as relationship rather than an agreement that is on the basis of a previously existing relationship. And those definitions of those different definitions of covenant are very key to understanding the federal vision. So, I mean, that's just a basic, you know, what's the main issue kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this affects, of course, it affects the covenant of works, covenant of grace dichotomy. It affects election. It affects justification, union with Christ. It affects perseverance, and a couple of other things as well.
Would it be accurate or inaccurate to say that the federal vision, because as we can see here, their view of the covenant permeates almost the entirety of the theological encyclopedia. I mean, mm-hmm. it has long-reaching roots and or claws, as the case may be. Would you say that it has affected its overall theology in a more Arminianizing direction?
Certainly. You know, they would deny that, of course, and they would say that, because they even say in their joint federal vision profession that no decretally elect person can fall from salvation. But the problem comes when the benefits of the Ordo Salutis, or at least the terminology of justification, adoption, regeneration, are applied to all without distinction. And so then you have this sort of nebulous third category, elect, non-elect, and then covenantally elect, but not decretally elect.
Hmm.
And so what happens is that these non-decretally elect, but covenantally elect people receive actual benefits from Christ's death in a way that in the language they use creates confusion and ambiguity because they're not very clear as to whether they are saved or are not saved.
Yes.
And actually there is some difference among some federal vision advocates even on that point, because Douglas Wilson has said on his blog and in debate with me that that a non-decretally elect person never was saved. And yet, even in his own theology, you know, what is a Christian? Well, Christian is someone who's baptized, kind
right.
of thing. And then also, and then other theologians of the Federal Vision are a little bit less careful than that. And what to say, you know, like Wilson or Wilkins and Lusk, for instance, are, I think, less careful in saying that that non-decretally elect people are never saved. They probably wouldn't say that.
So the outworking of this is almost seems to be a collapsing of the visible invisible distinction mm-hmm. of the church.
I think that practically speaking, that is what happens. Again,
okay.
they do say in their profession that the visible-invisible distinction is a legitimate distinction. However, practically speaking, they would much rather see the church as head for head. You know, what's true of one person is true of another, whether they're decretally elect or not. They prefer to speak in those terms, and so the result is this idea that the election, that decretal election, well, that's God's business, and that doesn't really have an effect on what we can say about people in the church or even about ourselves. And so that, of course, feeds into what I would argue is an undermining of assurance.
Because I was thinking that.
Reformed theology has always said that we can know that we are elect and we can have assurance of salvation. And this is what Cardinal Bellarmine said was the foremost problem of the Reformation, is that they were actually saying that we could actually know our election and know that we are saved.
Right. Robert Bellarmine called that the most pernicious doctrine, right?
Right.
Now, this is an idea that doesn't it leave you with a sense that the Christian life becomes almost a game? In other words, we play this game called church, and we don't know whether it will lead to have eternal, you know, rewards or not. And we can't have assurance. This is clear in Norm Shepherd's book.
Right. The only assurance that you can have is the assurance of the moment. You can't
or
know
of the sacraments, right?
Well, you know, as a former Arminian, I will tell, as a former pastor in the Arminian tradition, I can tell you that that's Arminianism by another name. But it's still Arminianism.
Right, but the issue here, of course, is that election means that we can be assured that we will always remain saved.
Right.
Whereas the assurance that the Federal Vision offers is a very visible assurance because it's fingerprinted and thumbprinted and all that. But the problem is that there are baptized people who remain in the church their entire lives and never visibly apostatize.
Right.
And by defining themselves, by defining a Christian as somebody who's visibly joined to the church like that, they have no real way to deal with the problem of the nominal Christian in the church.
Right.
I think that this is a good point, because I think that the best of the Reformation and Reformed tradition has, at least pastorally speaking, has directed the attention of God's people not to first and foremost the sacraments, although you can hear that and you can find that in the tradition. But it's always supplemented by, or at least qualified by, the idea of faith in the promises of God as being the source of our assurance. We walk by faith and not by sight.
This it almost reminds me, Lane, you may be familiar with this. Was it John Owen or was it John Flavel who had a debate with William Sherlock in the... Was it Owen over the and Sherlock? Did not Sherlock reduce union with Christ to church membership?
You know, I'm not remembering the debate myself. Carl Truman, but
yeah, no, there was it's very clear to me. I remember that there was a William Sherlock might have even been a bishop. I forget now, but in the Anglican Church. And he and Owen had a debate over the nature of union with Christ, and Owen was saying it is a real relationship based upon election, and Sherlock wanted to say no, it is merely church membership.
Yeah. Well, and church membership as union with Christ is fundamentally compatible with the Catholic tradition.
Yes.
The whole reason the visible-invisible church distinction gained such attention among the Reformed scholars was because Roman Catholics were asking them, hey, where's your church been for the last 15 centuries?
That's right.
Right.
And the Roman and the Reformers had to say, well, it's nominal Christianity that has been true, at least in the late Middle Ages, and there have always been a true church, but it has not always been visible.
Right. Now,
church district. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just asking: is this also not only a positive formulation, but is this a reaction to something in the church today?
Sure. The Federal Vision is definitely reacting to something that we Orthodox would also want to react against.
Right.
And that is the raw individualism of post-Enlightenment or Kantian Enlightenment philosophy, which basically undermines the authority of the church. You know, it was Calvin who approved of Cyprian's comment that you can't have God as your father without having the church as your mother. And right. that is a standard Reformed position on the church. And yet when you look at even Presbyterian and Reformed churches today, you find lots of people who think that the church is optional. The church is a nice thing, but you know, I don't really have to go all the time, or this kind of me and my Bible and Jesus kind of mentality that, and also a denigration of the sacraments too. I think that is a legitimate critique that the Federal Vision has of general evangelicalism. So they are definitely reacting, but as many critics have pointed out, the pendulum has swung too far.
Right. Lane, there seems to be a similarity between Federal Vision and Mercerburg theology, and especially Nevin, with regard to sacramentalism. And I'm wondering, you know, Nevin denied penal substitution, and it seems if you take away that Jesus is a complete savior in his death on the cross, you end up having to compensate with the sacraments elsewhere in your theology. Do you think any of that plays into this, even though the Federal Vision men would probably affirm penal substitution, that in reality they are really taking away from what Jesus did at the cross?
Yeah, I think, Rick Phillips, I think, has pointed this out, that the cross recedes into the background sometimes among the sacramental theology of the Federal Vision proponents. And I do think the Mercersburg theology has definitely come up for more attention. But we have to be careful there, because people like Daryl Hart, for instance, would probably deny Mercersburg influence on the Federal Vision. Certainly Mercersburg is very old school Presbyterianism in some respects.
Right.
In terms of how we view our children, how we view children, especially in regard to the revival traditions that were around in those days. And so I think we have to be careful, because there are elements. I mean, I consider myself old school Presbyterian. So, you know, yes. I'm not really huge on revivalist mentalities and that kind of thing. I do believe strongly in catechism and believing that we have no real reason to exclude children from the church.
Right.
You know, they're part of the church.
Right.
You know? So we, but to assume that they're regenerated is, you know, I think maybe going a little bit too far, but to assume that they're not is also problematic, because of course they can be regenerated from the womb. And so I think, you know, Mercersburg theology definitely had, I think, some issues and problems with regard to mysticism, especially in the sacraments. And I think you're seeing a return to that among some Federal Vision proponents. Sort of okay. this check your brain at the door kind of thing when it comes to the sacraments, especially the Lord's Supper.
Now, go ahead, Dick Camden.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've been looking through and following the PCA's 2007 joint study, the report that study produced. And they studied not only the Federal Vision, but also the New Perspective on Paul. And a lot of the aspects of the Federal Vision that you've mentioned seem to be very similar, maybe even identical at points with the New Perspective. Why do you think that is, and where is this influence coming from? Is this just coincidental, or is there a reason for these similarities? Particularly, I'm thinking about, like, in Perseverance, the double election seems to mirror the double justification, that kind of thing.
Well, I think I think you find this influence. This is probably one of the areas where a Federal Vision has an internal debate, because the influence primarily comes from N.T. Wright. I think there's no doubt about that. And N.T. Wright is viewed favorably by some. I could mention Mark Horn and Steve Schlissel, especially those two. But other Federal Vision proponents, like Douglas Wilson, for instance, are not so keen on N.T. Wright. So, but I do think that there are points of similarity with regard to future justification and the formulations that N.T. Wright has about Romans 2:13, among other passages. So I think there are some points of contact. And I do think that, to a certain extent, Federal Vision and N.T. Wright are reacting against similar things. The crass individualism, for instance. You know, N.T. Wright is all about, in some respects, he's all about the church and table fellowship and being unified. That's a very important concern to N.T. Wright. And I think that that concern is shared with the Federal Vision. But of course, you know, they originate in different spheres, because the Federal Vision is a churchly phenomenon, whereas the New Perspective is definitely an academic phenomenon.
That's right.
And I think so. While there are definitely points of similarity, but more maybe in what they're reacting against than in how they react to it. Although in certain cases, like Mark Horn and Steve Schlissel, you can see very clear appropriations of N.T. Wright's theology.
And Lane, wouldn't you say this is also based on the law-gospel distinction and their sort of rejection of that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the rejection of the law-gospel hermeneutic of Scripture is a key plank in the Federal Vision and how they, in terms of how they interpret it. And that is what leads them, I think, to reject the covenant of works, covenant of grace distinction.
Yes.
Or at least downplay the contrasts between those two covenants. So, you know, you have what winds up happening is you have a covenant of works that is really gracious by the end of it, and you have a covenant of grace that actually is not so gracious.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
so, right.
Legalistic, yeah. Mm.
Well, now, go ahead.
It flattens out the distinction, I'd say.
Yeah. What I was going to ask was that I think James Jordan's influence enters in there, doesn't it? He has a discussion of Adam in the Garden of Eden.
Right. His view is that that Adam was not going to it's a complete rejection of any idea of any thought of merit at all, and is advocating maturity, that Adam and Eve progress into maturity, but it would not be the eschatological body. You know, and this is the problem. You know, they usually portray the Adamic situation as already possessing eternal life.
Right. They have disrespect for the Sabbath day, pointing forward eschatologically.
Right. And there doesn't seem to be an adequate handling of 1 Corinthians 15. You know how Gaffin interprets 1 Corinthians 15. Well, I think, right. You know, that there was always an expectation of the eschatological body that was a whole step above the Adamic situation. And that was true. That was a built-in eschatological expectation right from the very beginning. And I think that that was to be earned in some way. It was not any kind of absolute merit or condign merit. Almost all Reformed scholastics reject that as a description of the Adamic situation. But it was an agreement that God had with Adam. So what they usually use say is that it's pactum merit, agreement by pact, or merit by pact. That, yes, Adam and God had a familial relationship, but that familial relationship does not negate the possibility that God would set for Adam a goal that Adam had to work towards. I think that's what the confession says in chapter 7.
Correct.
Lane, I was wondering what you think about Doug Wilson's definition of faith. I know over at your blog you guys have recently been talking about faith and the element of obedience. And in an article that Wilson wrote years ago on the New Perspective, he kind of redefines the three parts of faith, knowledge, assent, and trust, and says that trust is or involves obedience. What are your thoughts on all that?
Right. I am completely against saying that obedience is part of justification. Mm-hmm. I have no problem with saying that believing, I don't really have a problem with saying that belief or faith is a form of obedience, mm-hmm. but to say that that is part of the structure of justification, to me, it just negates the whole structure of justification, because justification is wholly gracious, and
yes.
there is no obedience involved at all unless you're talking about Christ's obedience. And so I reject Wilson's formulations on that. It's not because faith is obedient that makes it an instrument in justification.
Yes.
Mm. I think that faith as obedience is true, but it's not true in justification. I think right. you know the contrast between faith and works in Romans 3 and Romans 4 is very indicative there, and Ephesians 2 as well, that faith is a gift. And I think that's mm-hmm. a much better way to describe faith's part, its instrumentality in justification. It's only an instrument by God's grace as well. You know, its very presence is gracious, and Wilson wouldn't necessarily deny that it's gracious, but
right.
there's this tendency to want to put obedience into faith, and Norman Shepherd has this very same tendency.
Yes.
He defines faith and actually does not exclude spirit-wrought works from instrumentality and justification.
Right.
You can see that clearly in the Call of Grace. He says, yeah, we're justified by faith alone, but then how do you define faith?
Yes.
And if I remember correctly, Lane, Norman Shepherd does include language of instrumentality for works, right?
Yes, he does.
It's a dual instrumentality.
That's right. It's a dual instrumentality, and I think that is very, very problematic.
Well, it's a violation of the Westminster Standards, where it says that Absolutely. Faith is the alone instrument of justification. Right.
Now, remember, tie that in with the denial of the imputation of Christ's act of obedience, remember?
Hmm. Yeah.
So the two of them together are a deadly, deadly combination.
Right, and yes, I think I do agree, though, that that the denial of the imputation of the act of obedience of Christ is not true of all Federal Vision advocates.
Right, no, that, right. that's true.
Isn't but that some is, of the problem, of though, Shepherd. That... That is, yeah, with Shepherd. That isn't that some of the problem when we talk about the Federal Vision, it's not monolithic by any means, and so it's very slippery. So to say one thing, you're going to have a contingent who would call themselves Federal Visionaries, if that's the right word, who are going to say no, we don't think that, and so it's hard to pin it down and to really address some of the concerns that we have with the theology.
Right, I think that. You know, I think it's become quite a bit easier with the Joint Federal Vision Statement that was published in Credenda Agenda, because they did do a fairly careful job of saying these are issues we agree on, these are issues of intramural debate. You know, and I think that statement, the Joint Federal Vision Statement, needs to be foundational in describing the Federal Vision.
That's really good.
They themselves have mentioned this, and they are sometimes somewhat puzzled at the fact that we don't use this. I know Mark Horn's mentioned this, that critics are not using this as the basis for describing what the Federal Vision is. And I'm perfectly willing to say, okay, let's go with that. Let's call the Joint Federal Vision Statement the working document that describes what it is. So, yeah. But the imputation of Christ's act of obedience was listed as one of the intramural debate issues in that document, not as one of the things that they agreed on. Because I think Wilson holds the imputation of the act of obedience of Christ, and Mark Horn has said he does too, even though he argues against that being the only viable interpretation of the confession. So, you know, being careful to delineate all the various views is a very difficult process.
Lane, I remember reading Peter Lighthart saying that justification did involve the imputation of Christ's righteousness, but it also involved the infusion of that righteousness. Now, if you accept that, I mean, he's essentially denied the sufficiency of the imputation in justification. Would that be correct, by adding infusion?
Right. What he wants to do, what he wants to do is to include what Murray defined as definitive sanctification into justification. That's Lightheart's position. And the problem with that, of course, is that there's no way that you can further limit justification from including progressive sanctification, because I think definitive and progressive sanctification are all of a piece.
Yes.
I think Murray helpfully distinguished them, but he would certainly never say that we can separate those two things. So once you've got the camel's head in the door by saying that justification includes definitive sanctification, there's no stopping reunion with Rome.
Right.
Right.
That issue.
Do you think, is there a dislike for distinctions in the federal vision?
Among some, yeah. You can see that they love the slipperiness of language sometimes. They love to shift grounds of debate sometimes. I don't really necessarily have any definitive examples right now, but right. But you can certainly see, and I think what you're getting at is an implicit and sometimes explicit separation of systematic theology from exegesis.
Right.
I think that's a big issue. And of course, the federal vision isn't alone in that.
No, they're not.
View.
In fact, I'm writing a PhD thesis on the combination of those two things. What I'm going to try to write about is the unity of all theological discourse, and then take such a unified point of view and apply that to a critique of the federal vision.
Very good.
That's my thesis idea.
And then they pretty much set up a straw man and say, we're doing biblical theology, you're not. And we all here, I think, would love biblical theology. We would just have a different biblical theology.
Yeah,
that's exactly. Right. Yep.
Yeah. And I think what you're seeing then, and the difference is that we desire to have our biblical theology bounded by systematics. We don't just come to it. We don't just come to a biblical theological idea and say, oh, this makes plausible sense on it. Let's just run with it. We say, how does that fit in to our systematic theology? How does it fit into our confessional theology?
Right, exactly.
How did Lane Tipton put that in our last episode? He talked
about this came up, didn't it?
Yeah, BT and ST mutually informing one another.
Yeah, that's correct.
We talked about ST without BT is speculative. And what did he say? BT without ST is unbounded.
I forget it was related to the being blind and
being blind.
Without content.
I think it's so crucial. In fact, I was a little angry at Vern Poitras for stealing most of my thunder. But the article in the spring 2008 Westminster Journal is absolutely priceless, because he went back to Voss and showed that Voss believes that systematic theology has a normative impact on biblical theology.
Yes.
And I think that point is so crucial to make.
Yes,
absolutely.
So lost today. So,
there's a condensed version of that somewhat. I think he took and put in the new Westminster magazine that goes out.
Yeah, Westminster Today. Today has a shortened form of that.
But you're really going to want to read the article in the journal, though.
Yes.
You know, I have a copy of Voss's Systematic Theology that's still in Dutch. I wish somebody would translate it and get it out into print, because it would show that he was not against systematic theology.
Right.
And you can see that very clearly in what is maybe my favorite part of Voss, which is his history of covenant theology in the redemptive history and biblical interpretation. He has a marvelous condensation of almost all the major views of covenant on offer in Reformed scholasticism.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's right.
He knew all those scholastic theologians, and he quoted them, and knew them in context. And I think, Nick, you brought up his systematic theology. A lot of people don't even know that that's what he taught.
That's right. Covenant,
yes, at Calvin. At Calvin. Right.
Yeah. Of course, it wasn't Calvin Seminary in those days, but
right.
That's what he taught.
in connection with all this, I would, for our audience, recommend Jim Dennison's volume on the letters of Gerhardus Voss, because the bulk of those letters are letters written to two systematic theologians, Abraham Kuyper and Hermann Bavinck. And Voss was instrumental in bringing those men into the English-speaking world and worked laboriously to translate their work from Dutch to be published in English in the Presbyterian and Reformed Review under the oversight of B.B. Warfield. So, you know, his love and appreciation for systematic theology is, of course, made very clear in those letters, but also very clear in the article that Lane has mentioned. And then in all of his biblical theology, you could see his biblical theology is informed and has this constant interaction with confessional theology.
Yeah, and go ahead,
Lane.
When you look at the Reformed scholastics, they didn't say, "Oh, I'm going to do exegesis now. Now I'm going to do systematics. Now I'm going to do church history." It was all one happy jumble for them. And joyously so, you know, and when you look at a Brockle too, you know, practical theology is involved there too. Nothing was left behind in sort of this post-Enlightenment fractionalization of theological knowledge, which is it's one of the worst stepchildren of the Enlightenment is this this fractionalization of knowledge, where everything becomes more and more specialized, and each department views each other department with suspicion.
The in the Gaffin Festschrift, we mentioned this when we were interviewing Lane Tipton earlier this week, but there's a chapter by Bill Dennison where he contrasts Voss and Reformed biblical theology with Johann Gobler. He's our boogeyman, Gobler is, right?
Yes.
In many ways, the fountainhead, or at least an illustration of a bad form of biblical theology, of an Enlightenment-driven form of biblical theology. So not all biblical theology is good, right?
Right, and you can certainly see Voss wanting to rescue biblical theology from Gobler.
Yes.
Yeah.
See that very clearly in his biblical theology books. So.
Absolutely.
Lane, I'm wondering, how did you get involved in your study of Federal Vision? I came into Green Baggins probably a couple years into it. So, just briefly, how did you get involved in the whole thing?
Well, I had originally been studying N.T. Wright in towards the later part of my seminary education. I had sort of made a pact with myself that I would read all the major works of N.T. Wright, and I did accomplish that. And then, of course, you can't really be involved with Wright without talking with people who like Wright. So I was on the Wright Said group, in the Yahoo Wright Said group.
Yes.
And so I started debating Mark Horn quite a bit in that debate forum. And that, of course, sort of propelled me towards looking at the Federal Vision. And then in my own presbytery, there was originally a motion to receive the Mississippi Valley Presbytery Report in the PCA as our own presbytery report. But that got shot down because people wanted our own study committee report. And I wound up being on that study committee. And so the Siouxlands Presbytery of the PCA produced their own study committee report, and I was part of that. I was one of the two main authors of that, the other being Wes White, who is the next Richard Muller. So high praise, and I know he would probably say, "What are you doing saying that?" But it's true. He's read most of the post-Reformation tradition already, so and he's only a couple years older than I am. So, he and I wrote the Federal Vision thing, and that's kind of what and trying to get thoughts and trying to interact with Federal Vision proponents is really why I started putting Federal Vision stuff on my blog, and it brought a lot of people, and people seem to appreciate the back and forth. And it's, you know, the one niche that my blog has right now is that it's just about the only place left in either in print or in the blogosphere, where Federal Vision proponents and critics can still talk to each other.
Yeah,
right.
So, you know, it does have its own niche there, I think. Hmm.
Maybe before we get going, a couple things I want to ask you, but maybe if you just have a couple comments about blogs in general. I mean, that's kind of a contested topic, even especially among old school Presbyterians, and you have a very successful blog, and I think it's very helpful for the church, and it's an opportunity for us to have good discussion and to sharpen ourselves. What are your thoughts on this new medium? It's not that new, but it's new to many people.
Well, it has some strengths and weaknesses. The strengths are, of course, the immediacy of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can publish without anybody, without going through the normal channels of peer review and things like that. And, of course, that obviously has its negative side, too, because it's not nearly as polished or as careful as it might be if it were peer reviewed. I have sought from the beginning to make it a more scholarly blog than just spouting off whatever comes into my head. I do research for my blog posts and sometimes very serious research for it. But I think in general, you know, it allows a real-time conversation to happen sometimes that is helpful and is also something that remains after you do it so that you can still refer back to it. So it has some of the advantages of phone conversations, but it also has some of the advantages of print. The disadvantages are, of course, the lack of peer review, and this is why I think most of the Westminster East faculty have avoided blogs, is precisely because they are interested in producing peer-reviewed scholarship,
mm-hmm.
and blogs are not always conducive to that. So when you look at Carl Truman's blog posts, for instance, he doesn't pour his scholarship into those.
Right.
Right.
And so I think, you know, and there's some wisdom there, too, because, you know, if you're going to publish something, you want it to be peer-reviewed. You want it to be tested and you want it to be sharpened by mm-hmm. other scholars mm-hmm. in the field.
Jeff and
the other main disadvantage of blogging is that people oftentimes feel like they can put the most atrocious attacks on people.
Right, with no accountability.
Because they're not facing that person and talking to them in person.
It's appalling right? sometimes, really.
Yeah, some people are blog trolls. I mean, we have a category for this, for crying out loud, which irritates me no end. And I can't even read all of the comments on my own blog. You know, I have Reed DePace helping me with some moderation, moderating comments, and David Gadboy, and I don't know how I've forgotten to ask him how to pronounce his name, so I hope he's not offended. But I have some people helping with that. But, you know, it is so crucial in these internet debates to say to yourself, would I say this directly to the person if he was standing there in front of me?
Yeah.
And I think that would take a lot of the heat out and hopefully retain the light. So, I mean, it has advantages and disadvantages. So, but I appreciate it simply because I'm in the middle of North Dakota. This is my way of reaching the outside world. You know, it's funny, one guy on the Puritan board, which I would recommend to all our listeners, join the Puritan board if you have any kind of confessional basis for your theology and you want to join a discussion board that talks about everything.
Mm.
The Puritan board is a place to go.
I believe Andy Webb recommended that too when he was on.
Yeah, it's a yeah, wonderful place, and you'll see me there too a bit. But, you know, the thing about it is that that it's my connection to the outside world. And one guy on the Puritan board, they were joking around, somebody saying that I needed some form of church discipline. And this one guy said, I thought being in North Dakota was the church discipline.
Exile.
It's the Pat Moss of the United States.
Yeah.
So for me, it's my chance to talk with and interact with loads of people from the outside world there. So
nice.
That's kind of my take on blogging.
Jeff, you and I were talking just to bring the point up yesterday about the distinction between blog as a technology and then blog as how people use it. What I mean
That's
is,
right.
you know, it's a publishing mechanism, and a lot of people use the word in that form. Other times, people are speaking about my blog as my daily journal that said I ate Cheerios for breakfast, you know, and that's one way to use it, but they're not identical. So, you know, we need some precision when we're speaking. So anyway, that's my two cents. Back to the federal vision. We've mentioned plenty of books and authors, a couple websites. What are some resources we could point out to our listeners so that if they want to get more informed, they can go read and study?
Well, the best book is still, I think, the Auburn Avenue Theology Pros and Cons book that Fort Knox put out. It was the colloquium on the federal vision with seven or eight proponents for and seven or eight critics of it. And there you really see all the main themes are clearly evident in their own words and in critique. And this is not to denigrate Guy Waters' excellent contribution, but you know, if people want to have both sides, if they want to see the interaction, I think that that book is still the best. There is Guy Waters' excellent book, very well documented, despite some federal vision critiques of it, and in spite of Jack Collins's critique of it. I think Guy Waters has a specific reason, for instance, for quoting earlier versions of statements rather than later versions that are more modified. He has a scholarly reason for that, which is not appreciated by most people, and that's usually been the main critique leveled at his book. Although, of course, the ubiquitous claim of being misunderstood is also everywhere apparent in federal vision reaction to it. There's also a couple of other books, one by Brian Schwertley called, I think it's just called Auburn Avenue Theology. Let me just see here. I got it on my shelf. Yeah, Auburn Avenue Theology by Brian Schwertley. And then there's also a book by John Otis called Danger in the Camp. And those both books make lots of excellent points as well. So, I mean, there have been three full book-length critiques. I think that Guy Waters is the most scholarly of the three, certainly the most peer-reviewed, so probably the, and in my opinion, the most accurate of the three books. Mm. And of course, sources, original sources, you're looking at the book entitled The Federal Vision, which is edited by Dwayne Garner and Steve Wilkins, and also the Auburn Avenue Pros and Cons book. You've got Peter Lighthart's book, The Baptized Body. You've got Wilson's book. What is it? My mind's blanking now. The book I just spent a whole bunch of time going through. Reformed is Not Enough. Right. And also Jim Jordan's book, Through New Eyes, is an important seminal book. I think you'll find most of the hermeneutical tools used by the Federal Vision in that book. So, that, I mean, that's a pretty crucial book. I emailed John Barach about the Federal Vision, and he told me that Biblical Horizons was the Federal Vision, the newsletter that you can actually that you can get. So, you know, I think that's also a very important source material. You can also get the Auburn Avenue conferences on tape. If you don't have any time to read, you can hear what they say in their own words as well. And those are the main original and secondary sources. There are a couple of others. Jeff Myers' book, The Lord's Service, you've got Peter Lighthart's book, The Priesthood of the Plebs, and a couple of other things too. Peter Lighthart is coming out with a book on justification called Deliverdict. I don't know exactly when that's coming out. I asked him, and he says it's at the publisher now, and he doesn't exactly have an estimated time of arrival on that. But that'll be a crucial book, too, when it comes out. But Peter Lighthart's main position on justification is already evident in his articles. Mm. So I expect it to be more of the same.
Does anyone have any other questions for Lane before we get going?
Lane, it doesn't seem to be slowing down, the production of materials coming out from the Federal Vision camp. Is that true?
It's difficult to say. My impression has actually been almost the reverse, in the sense that most of the main blogs of the Federal Vision have kind of fallen silent on the issue. You know, you look at Jeff Myers' blog, and he posts a lot of photographs these days. Beautiful photographs, by the way, wonderful art. I've really appreciated it. Wilson is the only one blogging consistently on the Federal Vision, and that's because he's debating with me. Mark Horn has a few every now and again, and then there's the Biblical Horizons blog, which has just started, and but that one doesn't get a whole lot of attention in terms of the authors of that blog. The only one who really posts with any regularity is Stephen Wedgeworth. But in terms of print,
I guess I'm thinking in terms of print, yeah, books and articles and things like that.
In print, there hasn't really been much of anything in the last 3 years, except for Peter Lighthart's work and also Rich Lusk's book. What's it called?
Not by Faith Alone. Is that the?
No. Well, there is that book too, but that one's not specifically Federal Vision. Pato Faith, right? Pato Faith by Rich Lusk. The book Not by Faith Alone seems to me to be just rather quickly put together as a response to the Westminster, California book, which is also an excellent resource on both Federal Vision and New Perspective on Paul.
Whatever your justification of pastoral ministry.
Right. Whatever your position on Westminster East versus Westminster West on union with Christ and justification, it's still a marvelous tool. And I found it to be extremely incisive in everywhere that it counted. You do have the Sandlin book, but to me, the Sandlin book seems very slapdash and not very well put together. I'm kind of blogging through it right now, and there's not a whole lot that's new in that book. Not a whole lot of new argumentation. Shepherd has not, for instance, responded to some of his recent critics really all that well. Certainly didn't respond to Wes White, who I think mounted a very serious challenge to Shepherd's theology. Although we'll be interested to see what Guy Waters will say. He is nearing completion on a book on Norman Shepherd's theology, so you'll want to look out for that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Lane, I'm wondering what you think about the long-term, far-reaching effects of this with the formation of the CREC a couple years back, and do you think this is going to continue to spread, this and New Perspective on Paul?
I see the Federal Vision is having much less of an impact than the New Perspective. New Perspective already claims probably a third to a half of all New Testament scholars in existence.
Yes.
So you're going to see New Perspective as a much more serious threat to confessional orthodoxy than the Federal Vision, which I think has been rather effectively sidelined by all of the denominations that have already pronounced against it.
Yes.
So, you know, you have the OPC, the PCA, the RPCNA, the URC, and the RCUS, and there are a couple of others, I think, that have already pronounced against the Federal Vision. And so, you know, eventually, I think they're probably all going to wind up in the CREC. And as a matter of fact, I think the relationship between the Federal Vision and Reformed theology will be more cordial once they all are in the CREC.
Mm.
You know, it's because the errors of the Federal Vision, in most of the cases, are no more serious than the errors of Lutheranism or Episcopalianism. Sometimes, you know, with regard to the errors that some of them have with justification, they are as serious as Rome. Right. But in terms of baptism, it's very similar to Episcopalianism or Lutheranism.
Sure.
So, you know, I look forward to the time when we can interact with the Federal Vision, and not on the sense of you're trying to invade our denomination, but in the sense of now that we actually worship apart for the sake of unity, we can actually be aware of more of the things that we have in common. But it's just right now they're claiming to be confessional when all these denominations have said consistently that they're not. So that's my take on the long-term ramifications.
Well, we really like to thank you for joining us, Lane. This has been, of course, very fruitful. I think helping me to understand better exactly what the federal vision is and helping to solidify that. So thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll be back next week. But until then, why don't you visit castlechurch.org. You can read our show notes and view our bibliography. You can also find more information about our other programs and subscribe to our podcast feeds. If you'd like to get a hold of us, you can visit castlechurch.org/contact and send us your questions or your comments, or you can email us at christthecenter@castlechurch.org. We thank you for listening, and we look forward to having you back next time on Christ the Center.